Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. And so what we're going to do today is we're actually going to talk about the utilization of the exome sequencing in the pediatric and neonatal clinical settings. I'm going to start with the exome sequencing in the pediatric clinics, and then I'm going to turn over the presentation to Michael Lawson, who will continue the talk and present information about exome sequencing in the neonatal setting. So, Ambry Genetics is the pioneer in utilizing next-generation sequencing technology in the clinical setting. And in 2007, Ambry was actually the first company, one of the first commercial companies to purchase a sequencer with the Illumina Genome Analyzer. And in 2010, we actually brought the next-generation sequencing into the clinical setting with our 81 gene intellectual disability panel. And in 2011, started offering exome sequencing on a clinical basis. So some of the questions that we get about the clinical exome testing is whether or not the trio sequencing is performed upfront. What is the diagnostic yield and rate of certain results? How comprehensive is the medical review? Some of the important, more important questions to ask is, does the laboratory have a mechanism to curate newly characterized genes? And does the laboratory analyze and interpret novel genes? And actually, are the clinical reports clear, concise, and comprehensive? So going over the exome sequencing, we want to talk about what exons are, first of all. And exons are the protein coding regions of our genome. And they actually account for about 1 to 2% of our genome. And the reason why we are focused on exome sequencing, even though they only account for about 1 to 2% of the genome, is that when we see mutations in these exons, they account for 85% of the mutations that lead to Mendelian disease. And exome sequencing is a more cost-effective way of screening the human genome rather than whole genome sequencing. So when we talk about DNA analysis, molecular analysis, there are different options that clinicians have. From single gene tests to gene panels to whole exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing. And there are benefits and limitations to these tests. Single gene tests and gene panels are especially useful when there is a clear diagnosis in a patient. When the phenotype is overlaps with, there's a clear phenotypic overtype, overlap with the genotype. The whole exome and whole genome sequencing can be very useful when there's a newly characterized gene. So these are genes that are not available as a single gene test or are in these genetic panels. And actually what we've seen with our exome sequencing test is that 23% of our positive results from our exome tests are actually within these newly characterized genes. They can also be useful when we have patients with dual diagnoses or oligogenic findings, where the phenotype is not so clear. And so our experience is that 6% of our exome positive results have more than one diagnosis. And that's actually can confound the clinicians in deciding what type of genetic test, single gene panel, or single gene test or genetic panel for. There are also novel gene findings where, again, there is no single gene test or no genetic panel available. And 20% of our exome positive results are within these novel genes. Whole exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing actually gives us the ability to detect lower level mosaicism and heteroplasmy. So one of the benefits of single gene testing and gene panels is that you are able to get complete base pair coverage. Our experience with the whole exome sequencing is when we compared it with our cancer panel, 98% of alterations that were detected on our panels would have been detected through whole exome sequencing. So that gives us that lets us know that we're actually optimizing the sensitivity of our next generation sequencing technology. That's allowing us to detect alterations so that we're getting good base pair coverage. So our ExoMix test actually consists of whole exome sequencing on a trio, and the trio sequencing is generally done on the proband and the parents as well. We are also doing co-segregation studies and complementary studies both on first-degree relatives of the proband as well as any affected affected relatives, whether or not they're first-degree relatives. And getting samples from the trio as well as first-degree relatives can really assist in helping lower the turnaround time of our exome sequencing. We're also doing mitochondrial genome sequencing on our ExoMix test. And we're doing a comprehensive analysis both on characterized gene analysis, and when we're not finding an alteration on the characterized gene analysis, there is an automatic reflex to sequencing or to analysis of novel genes. We're also doing secondary finding options. And the clinicians do have an ability to opt out of these secondary findings. And the genes that we're targeting for the secondary findings are those recommended by, are the 56 genes that are recommended by the ACMG. So, there are two types of, exome tests that we're offering at Ambry. So our standard ExoMix test is the turnaround time is between 8 to 12 weeks. But what we're seeing currently is that our turnaround time is 9 weeks. The price is $5,800. We also have a quicker exome test, which is exactly like the ExoMix test, but we've modified the workflow to be able to provide clinicians with a quicker turnaround time. And that's called the ExoMix Rapid Test. Again, Michael Osborne is going to talk a little bit more about the ExoMix Rapid Test later on in this presentation. So as you mentioned, the mitochondrial genome is part of the ExoMix test that we're doing, and we're providing analysis through long-range PCR, and it's done in conjunction with the ExoMix test on a totally different machine called the MyFace machine, where we're doing the exome sequencing on the nuclear DNA on the HiSeq machine. And when we're doing the mitochondrial genome test, we're actually looking for the 64 mutations that are known to be pathogenic in the mitochondrial genome. We're also able to detect heteroplasmy as low as 5% in mitochondria. We're also able to pick up large deletions that are over 1 kilobase. The benefits of providing and establishing a diagnosis for patients is that in the pediatric genetics clinic, we're seeing that about 50% of children do not have a diagnosis. And not only does a molecular diagnosis help establish an inheritance pattern and provide options for families, but it also really helps clinicians to modify healthcare management. So it guides treatment, medical interventions, helps families get established and get referrals to specific appropriate specialists. Helps with pre-symptomatic screening for associated complications. And it really helps to eliminate unnecessary testing and further evaluation, unnecessary testing and evaluations for patients when they get a specific molecular diagnosis. And the family reproductive planning, it really helps with pre-implantation and prenatal diagnosis as well. Some of the common referrals and indications that we're seeing for exome cases are in the pediatric setting is that we're getting referrals for CNS disorders, cases with multiple congenital anomalies, neuromuscular disease, children with hematological disorders, cancer, syndromic and non-syndromic manifestations, children with developmental autistic and neurodegenerative disorders. And oftentimes these families have gone through what we call a diagnostic odyssey. They've had various biochemical assays done, genetic testing done, but they still don't have molecular diagnosis, again, either because the alteration that's causing the phenotype in the patient is a newly characterized gene, where there's no single gene or a genetic panel available, or the alteration is in the novel gene, so that the clinical testing would not be available for these patients. Sometimes the gene panels, genomic disorder can be suspected based on clinical findings with, again, no comprehensive genetic testing. And sometimes it's because the patient's clinical presentation, again, is unclear. Maybe because the phenotype is not typical for what we see as a suspected syndrome, or there are multiple oligogenic findings where a patient may have more than one diagnosis. So what is the diagnostic yield and rate of uncertain results that we're seeing for our exome sequencing? We're going to publish a paper where we've analyzed the first 500 exome cases that we've done. And what we're seeing is that we're actually getting a hit rate of 37%, so diagnostic yield of 37%. And the 30% of our diagnostic hit rate is coming from characterized genes. We're also seeing an additional 7% of our diagnoses are coming from novel gene analysis. So that's really helping to increase our diagnostic yield. We do have an uncertain result or variance of uncertain significance in 9% of these cases. So when we add array CDH to the exome, would be med clinicians have a potential hit rate of over 50%. Because using the array CGH, that gives a diagnostic yield of additional 15%. And again, so together, the array CGH together with the exome sequencing provides clinicians with the potential to diagnose about 52% of cases. Some of what's contributing to a high diagnostic yield is, again, we're doing trio exome sequencing on the proband and again, the parent. And that really helps us with our analysis of de novo GIS. Because half of our positive findings on our exome sequencing tests are actually from de novo alterations. We're also optimizing our bioinformatics with our highly sensitive variant calling. So we really are putting an onus on our clinicians and our clinical team to really filter out alterations that's based on the clinical manifestations and the phenotype of the patients and the cases that are presented to us. We do have a family history inheritance-based detection where we're actually using the family history to prioritize the alterations that we're seeing. And again, it really we're putting onus on the clinicians again to start filtering out alterations. Based on the family inheritance modeling that we're using. We're also using a personalized medical review with enhanced and comprehensive assessments. So it really is a collaborative effort between our lab directors and the clinical team here with the physicians and the genetic counselors that are sending out cases to really curate the information that we're getting on each case, and to really review case notes, previous genetic testing, or biochemical assays, or maybe cell-based surveys that have been done. And it really helps us pinpoint, and it really helps us in the interpretation of our of the exome. And we have an internalized database called CHAD, and it stands for the Characterizing the Disease-Causing Gene Database. And our internal database is really curated weekly from publications, and that really helps us keep up to date on being able to improve our bioinformatics internally. And if we're not seeing alterations on characterized genes, again, we're automatically reflexing two novel gene variant analysis for every exome case where, again, if an alteration is not found on a characterized gene. We're also doing family studies and co-segregation analysis to help with our interpretation of our exome results when appropriate. So again, we're asking for first degree relatives as well as affected family members. That really helps us in our interpretation of variants. Another question that we get is, what is our coverage? When we talk about coverage, the most important question to ask is what percent coverage are we getting with at least 10 base pair reads? And that's really important because, for example, if we guys that have an average of 100 base pair reads, you can see that these nucleotides with these dark bars on top of them, they represent species types that have more than 10 base pairs. Nucleotides with these blue bars over them, they represent the nucleotides with low base pair coverage or base pair coverage that are less than 10 base. So when we improve or we add polos to improve base pair coverage, we may be able to improve the average base pair read. So for example, if we get a base pair average read of 200, polos that we're adding really just stick to those nucleotides that already have the base pair coverage. So the percent that we're seeing with less than 10 base pair reads is still the same, regardless of whether or not, whether there's an average of 100 base pair reads or 200 base pair reads. What the ACMG is recommending is that, for a proband, there should be an average mean coverage of 100 reads, and for the trio, there should be an average of 10 base pair reads, and then every, we are getting a mean coverage of 100 base pair reads. So our base pair coverage, you know that 90 to 95% of our exome is covered with at least 20 base pair reads or higher. It really helps us in calling out germline heterozygous and homozygous variant colonies. And the quality of our reads, we're seeing that approximately 90% of the base pairs have a Q score of 20 or higher. And that translates to a base calling accuracy of 99%. And at Ambry, we do have an interactive gene coverage tool that's web-based. So if you have any questions about what type of coverage a specific gene is getting on our exome test, you can just plug in, for example, a gene in this tool, and it will tell you what type of gene coverage you're getting. And again, that's a free interactive tool that is available through our Ambry website. So how comprehensive is the medical review? Does the laboratory have a mechanism to curate newly characterized DNA? And does the laboratory analyze and interpret novel DNA? I've gone over these topics a little bit, but I'm going to go over them in a little bit more detail in this section. So we do have, again, our family inheritance-based detection where we use the family modeling to help prioritize alterations. And even though, for example, in the family, an alteration may look like it's autosomal dominant, we'll look at every possible family modeling to really prioritize alterations and to really put the onus again on our clinical lab directors to manually filter out these alterations, so that they're not missing any variants that could potentially provide a diagnosis for a family. We also have a personalized medical review with enhanced and comprehensive assessment. And again, that really helps our clinical team. That's the way our clinical team really reviews the medical records that is provided by each clinic. And again, that's why we ask for previous a genetic test results, clinical notes, cell surveys, anything that may help us correlate alterations with the phenotype that's being seen in the clinic, so that we know if an alteration that we're seeing, is helpful in the diagnosis. And what the clinician is seeing in the office. So if an alteration is not seen on our internal characterized database, We do automatically reflex to novel gene analysis. And novel gene analysis is really based on gene function and animal models. And animal models generally are mouse models that, again, help us to provide a diagnosis for our families. We also look at the pathogenicity of the alteration, so whether an alteration is a frame shift mutation, whether it's a truncating nonsense mutation, whether it's in a canonical splice site. We also look at the disease mechanism. Is it a phenotype based on a loss of function or a gain of function mutation? Is it co-segregating within the family? So again, that is something that we look at, and that's all part of our primary report. Can we, a CHAD is acronym that we use for our internal characterizing disease-causing gene database, and it is a systematic weekly review of medical literature and published in published journals for recently characterized genes. And it's very important to keep up to date with these characterized genes because our experience is that it has accounted for 23% of our exome positive cases. So we know that just looking at PubMed or Omen, where these mutations may not have been part of that published or that public database, is not sufficient alone. So we really need to look at other literature out there. And it really comes from the pitfalls we're only aiming to increase base pair coverage, because if we're only looking at base pair coverage, we may be overlooking characterized genes. So we're certainly, our lab is certainly working to improve our base pair coverage, but we want to look further beyond that, so that we're also looking at exon-wide coverage as well, and not just being too narrowly focused on base pair coverage. And again, it highlights the importance of not only depending on HGMD and only public databases, but also looking at other published papers out there. And again, the recently characterized genes are one of the biggest contributors to our high diagnostic. Our CHAD internal database has also resulted in several unsolicited gene classification reports of prior negative and uncertain results. And so we're automatically recontacting clinics and generating reports if the variant is downgraded to benign or upgraded to likely pathogenic. And we feel that it's important to reclassify results both ways, because if it's downgraded, then it can, for the patient, it really can prevent unnecessary screening, unnecessary referral. But again, if it is upgraded, obviously it can, again, alter management and treatment with the addition of referral to specialists and additional monitoring for the patient. So one important, I'm going to go through a case report example where we actually received a case on a patient who had multiple congenital anomalies with developmental delay. It sounds very similar to a lot of referrals we get in the genetic clinic. And when we did the exome sequencing, there was actually a hit and a diagnosis for Pitt-Hawkins syndrome. And when we went back and looked at the case, this patient's phenotype was not obvious, did not obviously there was no obvious correlation with the patient's phenotype to a diagnosis of Pitt Hopkins. Because only 38% of the patients only had 38% of the features consistent with Pitt Hopkins syndrome. So the patient did have some characteristic facial features of Pitt Hopkins. She also had a developmental delay, including speech delay. She also had motor incoordination, ataxia, and stereotypic movement. She also had hand anomalies, including a palmar crease anomaly. But she didn't have some of the hallmark features of Pitt Hopkins, including the ocular anomalies and the episodic hyperventilation. So the molecular analysis was just based on the patient's phenotype, the Pitt Hopkins, would not be something that the clinician would have ordered. So we're seeing a paradigm shift from ordering genetic testing based on a patient's phenotype, where the phenotype really drives the type of molecular analysis clinicians are ordering. The genotype is really helping us to understand the phenotypic spectrum of certain genetic conditions as well, because the case reports of, that we see on specific genetic syndromes, they're generally based on the more severe end of the spectrum. So those cases that are obviously have the hallmark features of specific syndromes. But with exome sequencing, we're able to understand what the wider spectrum of genetic syndromes look like, from the milder end of the spectrum to the moderate end of the moderate end of the spectrum. So the exome sequencing has really been a successful tool for helping us understand what Mendelian diseases look like and what the phenotype looks like for these Mendelian diseases. And so from January 2007 to July of 2013, what we're seeing is that our understanding of these phenotypes of genetic disease has actually doubled in these 6 years between 2007 and 2013. Part of our exome analysis does include automatic reflex to novel gene variant analysis when there's no alteration detected on a characterized gene. And it explains the possible diagnosis in 12% of cases with no significant findings in characterized genes. And we do have a strict criteria for reporting novel genes. They must be either autosomal recessive or de novo autosomal dominant. The alterations must affect the major isoform or the isoform abundantly expressed in the affected organ. So we do know that that isoforms are relevant to specific tissue types. So, for example, if we see alteration in transcript that affects maybe the pancreas, but in the case that we're seeing, there is no pancreatic involvement and there's brain abnormalities, that's not an alteration that we're going to report on our novel gene variant analysis, because we know that the alteration, the isoform is not abundant or does not affect the brain. The mutation type criteria has to be likely pathogenic, and we do an inheritance-dependent criteria that's really based on the healthy population variant data. So it has to be an alteration that's not that is not common in general healthy population. It's not the polymorphism. And there has to be good evidence based on at least two of the following. We have to have good evidence of gene function and expression. We also have to have good animal studies, mostly mouse studies. And the alteration that we're seeing has to be involved in a gene or protein family that is involved in the clinical presentation of each case that we're getting, the phenotype. And it has to be in association with an overlapping microdeletion syndrome. And we are having a webinar in December that's going to go over how we're doing these novel gene analysis. So again, stay tuned. It'll be posted on our website, but we're going to have a webinar in December that reviews our novel gene variant analysis. So for our reporting categories, for our characterized genes, we're only reporting out alterations if they're positive, if they're likely positive, if it's the variance of unknown significance, or if it's negative. For alterations that we're finding in our novel genes, we're only reporting them if they're likely positive or if they're possibly positive. So we're not reporting down variance of unknown significance in novel genes. Again, our novel gene analysis has really enabled us to add to our to characterizing new genes. So so these are the genes that we've been seeing through our exome, and the larger the gene is, the more hits that we've been seeing, the more alterations that we've detected on these genes through our exome. So again, we do know that the exome is a powerful test for helping diagnose patients, but it is not the end-all and be-all test. The exome really is a companion test to array CGH because there are some limitations to the exome test. The exome is not validated to detect large rearrangements or copy number variations. So for that, the array CGH in the microarray is really still the first line test to detect copy number variations. We're not detecting trinucleotide repeat expansions, and we can't the exome sequencing cannot be used for exome receptor mutations in females who are manifesting a disease due to food exome deficiency. So some of the referrals that we're seeing for the microarray test is for patients with multiple congenital anomalies, for patients with developmental delay and cognitive impairment. And it really is the first tier test for patients with these indications. And there was a publication in the American Journal of Human Genetics in 2010, and the consensus guideline was that the chromosomal microarray is a first-tier clinical diagnostic test for individuals with developmental disabilities and cognitive anomalies. And the microarray technologies are two different microarray technologies, the array CGH and the SNP array. They both detect deletions and duplications. And one of the big differences is that the comparative genomic hybridization is a competitive type of hybridization. And the resolution of the CGH truly depends on the probe and the probe spacing and the density of the probe. With the SNP array, we can additionally detect unicorrential glycine and suspicion of cross-synchronicity through loss of the regions of homozygosity and losses of heterozygosity. So the microarray, again, there's additional 15% detection rate that we're getting with the microarray, so combined with the exome test, there's about a 52% diagnostic hit rate. And the turnaround time of the microarray is lower than the exome. And there's a cost difference that needs to be weighed when considering which option to do first. And with that, again, because the array CGH and the exome do provide such a powerful diagnostic tool, we felt that it was important to be able to modify the workflow and give clinicians access to results more quickly. And that's what we're doing with the exome rapid test, right? The exact same test as the exome, but the workflow has been modified to be able to provide a quicker turnaround time. And with that, I am going to turn over the presentation to Michael Osborne.
All right. Thank you, Kathy, for the introduction, and thank you, everyone, for listening into the webinar today. Okay, so as Kathy mentioned, I'm going to be talking about the Exome Next Rapid for the second half of the presentation. And what I really want to start out by stressing is that the Exome Next that Kathy just talked about and the Exome Next Rapid are essentially the exact same test. So it's the exact same technology. Each sample is going to receive the same analysis and attention. But the big difference is the turnaround time, as well as price and billing. The price for Exome Next Rapid is going to be $15,129, which is more expensive than the list price for Exome Next. But the turnaround time is quoted at 2 to 5 weeks. So you are going to get results much faster. At this moment, we are averaging a turnaround time of about 3 weeks. The other difference is that at this time with Exome Next Rapid, we are not accepting private insurance, so that's going to be institution or patient pay only billing. But again, the test itself, Exome Next Rapid, is going to be the same as Exome Next. So we're going to start by performing whole exome sequencing up front of the entire trio. Co-segregation analysis, mitochondrial DNA sequencing is included. We'll start with characterized gene analysis and then automatically reflex to novel gene analysis. And then, again, the same consent process and options for secondary findings. I do also want to stress that we can only guarantee the turnaround time of 2 to 5 weeks if we do have the entire trio, so preferably the proband mother and father. So possible indications for Exome Next Rapid, of course, it would include any situation where you might require or need results back quicker than the 8 to 12 week turnaround time of just traditional Exome Next. So this might be something like a newborn with multiple congenital anomalies, particularly in the setting of a normal karyotype and microarray. Oftentimes, the karyotype and microarray will be performed prenatally. Oftentimes, a newborn with multiple congenital anomalies may also have a lengthy differential list, and there might be overlapping features that suggest multiple possible genetic syndromes. So the Exome Next Rapid would allow you to get results back much quicker in the NICU or neonatal setting. An additional indication for Exome Next Rapid might be a suspected metabolic syndrome, where quick intervention is necessary in order to get a more favorable outcome by early intervention. So possible symptoms or features of a metabolic syndrome, of course, can include poor feeding, vomiting, failure to thrive, lethargy, any sign of rapid deterioration or decompensation, specific food aversion, seizures, or hepatoencephalopathy. And then another indication where it might be worthwhile to consider Exome Rapid is in the setting of some international patients. So there are occasional cases, where an individual has limited time in the United States and is self-pay. And so starting with Exome Next Rapid, especially if there is a lengthy differential list, might provide answers to this particular patient or family in a timely manner and in a manner that best suits their current needs. So Kathy already discussed a little bit about the preliminary or the data from our first 500 exome samples, I just want to highlight that of those first 500 exome samples, 28 were actually received from the neonatal or NICU population. And for the purpose of our data, we defined neonatal as any patient presenting with symptoms prenatally or within the first 4 weeks of life, and the patient submitted for diagnostic exome sequencing at 4 months of age or less. So again, of our first 500 exome samples, 28 individuals did fit that criteria. Of those 28 samples, 14 or 50% were classified as positive or likely positive. 10 or 36% were classified as negative, and then 4 were classified as uncertain. Of those 50% or of the 14 that were classified as positive or likely positive, 79% of those findings were in previously characterized genes, and 21% were in novel genes. So I just want to go through a few case examples of different scenarios and different samples that we have received in the laboratory. So program one presented prenatally with bilateral hydronephrosis, posterior urethral valve, enlarged bladder, and echogenic bowel. There was also a question about possible Hirschsprung's disease. The family history was significant for a full sibling with neurogenic bladder and bowel. And prior genetic testing that had been performed included a SNP microarray analysis, which was reported as normal. And coverage provided by this particular microarray was quite extensive, covering 2.696 million probe targets. So again, exome sequencing was sent to Ambry, and we did find a positive, or this patient did have a positive result. A probable disease-causing alteration was detected in the ACTG2 gene. This is a specific mutation that was detected in this patient. And then on the report, we also provide this pedigree analysis. And what you can see by these little stars above father, mother, and proband, the star indicates that whole exome sequencing was performed on all three of these individuals. The pathogenic ACTG2 mutation was found in the proband and was not located in mother and father. And then co-segregation analysis was performed on the sister that, remember, also had the neurogenic bladder and bowel. And we found that this particular missense mutation was tracking through through the family and was present in the sister. So this represents an example, a likely example of germline mosaicism in this particular pedigree. For program two and the second case example that I'll go through, program two presented at 1 month of age with abdominal distension, bilious vomiting, dilated bowel and stomach, and megacystitis. In this case, the family history was non-contributory, and there was no evidence of prior genetic testing in the records that were sent to us. However, this proband was evaluated in the NICU by a pediatric geneticist. And similarly, in proband 2, you'll see that we also found a gene mutation in ACTG2. This one was also a missense mutation. And again, the family pedigree was provided, which shows that in the proband, we did detect this particular ACTG2 mutation, and the mutation was not present in either the mother or the father. So again, one of the things that I want to highlight by, or that I think rather is highlighted by these two previous case examples is that exome is a tool that can be considered when a genetic disorder is based on, is suspected based on clinical findings, but that there are currently limited or no comprehensive panels available at the time. So what you can see here is actually a screenshot from GeneTest that I took from last week, so August 17th. And for ACTG2, there is no sequence analysis available at this time. So even though in the previous two cases, both proband 1 and proband 2 were suspected to have this particular syndrome, which I'll talk about in just a moment, there is no genetic testing available for ACTG2 at this time. There is deletion duplication analysis available for an allelic disorder, through one lab in the United States, but again, not available, that would not have been available for the two prior programs that we discussed. So about the same time that these two cases were sent to our lab, two papers were published in both 2013 and 2014 that described de novo and inherited ACTU2 mutations as causative for congenital distended bladder, microcolon, and intestinal hypoperistalsis. This particular condition is also called megacystis microcolon intestinal hypoperistalsis syndrome. It's also been described as familial visceral myopathy and as Burden syndrome. Dr. Burden is the doctor who first described this particular condition in 1976. The second article that you see, so Wengler et al. Was published in 2013, they actually took 11 unrelated probands that had all been clinically diagnosed with this MMIH, megacystis, microcolon, intestinal hypoperistalsis syndrome, and performed whole exome sequencing in all 11 of these individuals. And they actually found both, again, de novo and inherited mutations in ACTG2 in 6 out of 11 of these probands. So, of course, that means that there are 5 out of the 11 that we did not find ACTG2 mutations, and so there's probably further genetic heterogeneity there, but it did identify ACTG2 as a candidate gene for this MMIHS syndrome. So what I want to also emphasize for these two particular cases is that with ACTG2 mutations, these individuals generally undergo repeated abdominal surgeries. They can suffer hepatic complications from total parenteral nutrition. They're susceptible to poor nutrition as well as infectious complications of ileostomies and intravenous urinary catheters. And so one of the previous papers that I referenced, Thorson et al. 2013, stated that it is important to make a diagnosis as early as possible since life expectancy is significantly decreased without extensive surgical operations consisting of multivisceral transplantation. So again, this would be a case where if MMIHS is clinically suspected, exome next rapid might be considered in order to get confirmation of a diagnosis as rapidly as possible, as all previous papers thus far have suggested that the earlier the diagnosis and therefore the earlier the intervention, the better the prognosis. And then finally, the last case that I want to highlight really quick, Program 3 was evaluated at 9 months of age. They were noted to, their medical history was consistent or notable for developmental delay, multiple congenital anomalies, including ear tags with small canals, facial pits, abnormal facial hair, optic nerve dysplasia, and micronasia. Examination was also consistent with microcephaly, poor weight gain, and narrow ear canals with conductive hearing loss. Some of the prior evaluations that Proband 3 had undergone included an upper GI, which was normal, spinal sonogram, which was normal, echocardiogram was normal, skeletal survey was significant for minor non-specific anomalies, and then a brain MRI revealed partial agenesis of the corpus callosum and midline lipoma. And in this case, the family history was also non-contributory. This individual, Program 3, had also previously undergone pretty extensive cytogenetic and molecular genetic testing, including a normal karyotype and normal SNP microarray. Molecular genetic testing for Treacher-Collins syndrome had also been performed, so sequencing and deletion duplication analysis of TCOX1, POLR1C, and POLR1D, as well as sequence analysis for SOL1, which is associated with Townes-Brock syndrome. And all of this prior genetic testing had returned normal. So again, exome was sent to Ambry for analysis, and we found biallelic mutations in the UBE3B gene located at chromosome 12. This is an autosomal recessive condition, and bilateral UBE3B mutations are associated with Kaufman oculocerebrofacial syndrome, which has also been called blepharophimosis ptosis intellectual disability syndrome. And what you can see is that the biallelic mutations were identified in the proband. I did not put the family pedigree on this slide, but both disease-causing mutations were also confirmed in the proband's mother and father. I just want to emphasize that for this particular case, there was a lengthy differential. So extensive genetic testing had already been performed, including karyotype microarray and sequence analysis of 4 different genes. And even if this particular condition, the Kaufman oculocerebrofacial syndrome, had been suspected, at this time there is no genetic testing available for that particular condition. Again, at about the same time that this case was sent to our lab, 2 papers were published that described loss of function of this particular gene and implicated loss of function of UBE3B as causative of Kaufman oculocerebrofacial syndrome, as well as blepharophimosis ptosis intellectual disability syndrome. So reported features of UBE3B, according to these papers, can include the characteristic facial features, intellectual disability, growth retardation, microcephaly, hypotonia, variable seizures. It can also include absent speech, ectodermal anomalies, growth retardation, and reduced cholesterol levels. So in addition to providing a diagnosis for proband 3, whole exome sequencing in this case also added to the medical literature, suggesting that, again, biallelic mutations in UBE3B are causative of this particular condition called an oculocerebrofacial syndrome. So at this time, Kathy and I would like to acknowledge the Ambrygenetics Clinical Diagnostic Exome Team, as well as some of our clinicians from various universities that allowed us to present these particular cases. So from Columbia University, that would be Dr. Anyane Yeboah and genetic counselor Ashley Wilson. And at this point, I would like to turn things over to Stephanie Gangioni. Stephanie is going to moderate our question and answer session.
Thank you, Michael and Kathy. I would like to introduce a few additional members of our pediatric genetic specialist team. We have a team of 4 professionals, Kathy, Tahila, Michael, and Sarah, and we'll soon be adding a 5th member, Ben, and I put their contact information on there, so feel free to give them a call or an email if you would like to pursue additional educational opportunities or make contact with them in order to learn more about Ambry's testing options. We also have another webinar coming up in a few weeks on, so please mark your calendars for September 10th at 11 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. We will be hosting an educational webinar about the applications of diagnostic exome sequencing among patients in the neonatal intensive care unit. This is actually a data sharing webinar specifically targeted towards a more in-depth look at exome sequencing as it applies to the clinical diagnosis in the neonatal patient population. Okay, well, since we are on a couple minutes past time, I just wanted to thank everybody again for attending our webinar. Please keep checking our website for ongoing educational and CEU events, and we look forward to seeing you at upcoming conferences starting in the next few weeks. Have a great afternoon.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.